Therapy Notes is the highest rated EHR, practice management, and billing software for mental health professionals. Its all-in-one platform is designed to streamline all aspects of your practice, from connecting with clients via secure messages to scheduling, notes, billing, and more. You can trust Therapy Notes has you covered. And one of the best parts? 24/7 customer service with a live person. It's beyond easy to get help over the phone or by email at any time of day from their knowledgeable and friendly representatives. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today. Therapy Chat Podcast, episode 482.
This is the Therapy Chat Podcast with Laura Reagan, LCSWC. The information shared in this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health professional. And now, here's your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC.
Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and this week I have a new episode for you with a guest who has come into my awareness multiple times because of the many intersections between apparently our interests and our work. My guest today is Dr. Hillary McBride. Hillary McBride is a psychologist, teacher, researcher, author of multiple books, a clinician and a podcaster, and I'm sure much more. Those are just some of her work parts of her life. And today we're talking about embodiment and disembodiment. And we're also going to talk about her podcast, which is called Other People's Problems. And season 5 is coming out this week. In our conversation, we talked about something that I have been really attuned to lately, which is this kind of idea of trauma porn and how people are out there on podcasts, on YouTube, other places, on reality shows, sharing their experiences of that were traumatic. And it can be really important to feel like you are being heard and also sharing your story for the benefit of others. But there's a reason that I don't have survivor stories on my podcast, because I don't have in place a way to ensure that the person is really giving consent to this information going out to a wide audience. I don't have a way to ensure that they are understanding what it might feel like for them to have people hear their story or to tell their story on a podcast. So sometimes my guests may share from their lived experience, and most of them are therapists. So I feel like there's kind of a expectation that they understand what they're agreeing to do when they do that. They're choosing that of their own accord. But, you know, there are a lot of podcasts out there where the host is not a clinician or any kind of a mental health professional or helping professional at all. And the guest may be sharing for the first time something that is really impactful, and it can end up causing them to feel dysregulated. The host may feel dysregulated and the audience may feel dysregulated. So I wanted to know, because Other People's Problems discusses or actually shares recorded therapy content, I wanted to know, how do they ensure that there's informed consent and that people really are protected to the best of anyone's ability from the emotional fallout, the impact that that may have? And I asked Hillary about that, and she gave an answer that was like really thorough and made me feel very reassured that the process that they use on Other People's Problems to ensure informed consent is robust. With that said, I think it's extremely valuable to be able to kind of like pull back the curtain on what happens during therapy, because people have their own conception of what therapy is like and You know, I'm not going to talk to a stranger about my problems, but there's so much beautiful, powerful work that happens in therapy. And hearing other people's experiences can be very inspiring for those of us who have never tried therapy and really could benefit from it. So I think that her podcast, Other People's Problems, is really pretty cool. And it's the new season comes out this week in alignment with the time that we're releasing this. We also talked a bit about psychedelic assisted therapy. We talked about her newest book a little bit, Holy Hurt. It's spiritual abuse and embodiment and disembodiment and much, much more. So I'm very excited to share this conversation with you, and I hope you will enjoy it as much as I did. Next week, I'll be bringing you an interview with Dr. Stephen Porges and Karen Onderko about their new book, Safe and Sound, about the Safe and Sound Protocol. The following week, you'll be hearing another new interview with my colleague, teacher, and friend, Paula Scataloni, which is also about the Safe and Sound Protocol and the provider's presence in the experience of delivering safe and sound and receiving it for the person who's listening. So can't wait to share those new interviews with you and a whole bunch more. As always, thank you for listening to Therapy Chat. I hope you will find some interesting, thought-provoking ideas in today's conversation. Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and today with me is Dr. Hillary McBride.
Hello, it's so good to be with you. To you, hello. Laura, and everyone who's listening.
Yes, thank you. Same to you. I'm so glad you're here and very excited to talk with you. Before we get into our topic, which I'm kind of thinking of as embodiment and disembodiment, and, you know, we'll talk about that in more detail, but let's start off with you telling our audience a little bit more about who you are and what you do.
Ooh, okay. So there's the easy answer, which is I'm a registered psychologist. I teach, I research, I write, I have a clinical practice, I supervise, all of those kinds of things. But I've been moving more and more away from that description when I am introducing myself in this context as a way of reminding myself that actually the thing that undergirds all of that is this, I'm a person who's curious. There are so many places I want to go inside of myself and inside of other people. There is this, my approach to life really has been so much organized around wonder. And to me, that feels like the central, that's the thing underneath the role and all of those different expressions, is that I want to experience the world and I want to know, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be me? What's inside of you? And then, my job is, a way to ask and potentially, adventure into some of those questions.
Yeah. Well, I do want to ask, as a researcher, what particularly do you research, or what's your focus?
Yeah. So my program of research includes a couple of different things. The first one is embodiment across the lifespan, particularly women's experiences of embodiment at various stages of development. And so that has been part of my program of research since early on in grad school. And then with that, there has been perinatal mental health. I've done quite a bit of research in the area of postpartum sexuality, and looking at women's experiences of well-being perinatally as explained through their own lived experience and their voices. And then kind of how it looked a little bit more in my doctoral work was menopause, perimenopause, later in life, experiences of embodiment for women, particularly in this kind of disruption of the narrative of women's bodies angle. That's kind of the angle that I usually take. And then I've done some research in psychedelic psychotherapy, working particularly in this area of spiritual and religious trauma and purity culture, things like high religious control around sexuality environments, and looking at what that does to embodiment. So again, you can see this kind of unifying flavor. Mm-hmm. And then randomly, kind of distinct from all of these other things that I've been a part of, I worked with a colleague of mine on a 4-year study about the the pandemic and what it was like for people to have growth and transformational experiences in the middle of the pandemic. So specifically, kind of taking this existential approach, most of my research is qualitative and hermeneutic phenomenological, but really looking at when things are horrible, when everything shuts down, when your whole world is disrupted, yeah, there are going to be a group of people who this feels unsurvivable in a way, completely destructive. And then there is also a group of people who felt like it moved them towards their experience of their core self, that in some way they met themselves and changed for the better. And so we researched that population and were fascinated by the process by which they came to this kind of emergence of the self. So that sits outside some of my other research, but yeah, body stuff, right? Looking at what does it mean to be a body? How do we disrupt the cultural narratives of bodies? How do we reclaim and remember ourselves as bodies in a way that gives us access to agency, power, connection, freedom, and of course, like good mental health outcomes, that too.
And good sex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you so much for how you answered that, because, you know, as I was hearing you speak, I'm like thinking, wow, I've heard your name for a long time and sort of like peripherally to things that I was looking at or interested in, or other people I was interested in, and hearing that you've worked with them, or, and I see why now, because these, you know, different aspects of what you do intersect with so many of the things that I'm really curious about too, like perinatal work, perimenopause, embodiment and psychedelics and agency and transformation. Really curious to, I know this is sort of like you said, side to your other work, but is the COVID, the pandemic time work out there somewhere in a book or a study or something like that?
We published
it. Because I'd like to read that.
Yes. Yeah. It's really interesting. I think 2024, it came out, Counseling Psychology Quarterly, it was published in.
Okay.
And the authorship would be McBride and Joseph. So if you look for McBride and Joseph, and I think it's called An Accelerated Emergence of the Self. That's the actual title. It's so funny. We published it. I think I have it around here somewhere, but these things that we work on for years and years and years, and then all of a sudden.
Yeah. It comes out and you're on to the next thing.
I know, yeah, exactly. So if you look up McBride and Joseph 2024, Accelerated Emergence of the Self, I think is the paper title. But it's a hefty one. I think it might be like a 40-page paper.
Well, it makes sense published. Because it's a pretty big topic.
It's a pretty big topic. And I think what, you know, was really inspiring about that, we were the first researchers to ever publish a paper using AEDP as a theoretical framework. So AEDP is mostly a therapeutic modality. And we were using specifically the component of that theory that explains and identifies how transformational experiences occur in the midst of challenge. We were using that as our theoretical framework, and that hasn't been done before. So what it showed us, and this I think is the case with pretty much all good research, something that was new, but something that was old. And in the sense, something that was old is something that we just kind of know in our bones and something that we've heard before, and it gets recycled generation to generation. And it took us back to Viktor Frankl's work around, if you are with the hard and you make choices in the middle of it, that you can go some places, right? That might surprise you with that, including finding agency, including finding connection and possibility in the midst of suffering. So we have the findings, I think, really highlight what most of us need to know on some level, which is that if we stay with the feeling and we stay with the feeling long enough, and we're supported to do that in an embodied, experiential, and likely relational way, that there is something that's underneath the feeling. And the thing that's underneath the feeling might be a core true sense of what we need, of what we know, of what we need to face. Because what we found in the research was people's worlds were disrupted. And I mean, so much Like, this was not a population who was extremely wealthy. This was not a population who was all white. This was not a population who entirely had their jobs intact. Like, when you look at our research sample, these were people who had no income all the way to, like, had to leave their jobs and move back in with their families, or came out as trans, or realized that they had been running from their childhood abuse their whole life. And when everything stopped, they couldn't run anymore. And they actually stayed with what was inside of them long enough to let it start to bloom. And it's just a fascinating paradigm for, I think, for all of us. Like, when things are hard, what do we do?
Yeah. And I mean, I love that. Thank you so much for explaining about that. And I'm going to look up the article, and hopefully if I can find it and link to it for this, I will. You know, I don't know if the access
I can
will be
send
free
that to
or
you.
Not, but we'll try. Oh, that would be wonderful. Thank you. Yeah. And of course, here in the US right now, we're going through what can feel pretty unbearable in terms of the turmoil and the conflict and violence and change and uncertainty. And so once again, just like during the pandemic, which, you know, still going on, mm-hmm. is, you know, how do we, life is not just fun and games. It's not just go shopping and, you know, get rich. It's hardships. No matter who you are, no matter how much or how little you have, there are hardships that we all experience and losses. And, you know, there's also hundreds of years of effects of colonization. And, you know, it's like things are bubbling and roiling and it's scary. And how do we go on? And that's, again, like embodiment, disembodiment. Do we just pretend it's not happening? Do we just come out of our bodies and be like, they're the problem, go fight, attack, you know? Or do we connect and find the shared humanity between us and have agency and take action in ways that are empowered, not out of a trauma reaction? It's a fascinating subject, but it's not just an intellectual curiosity, no. Right?
No. And the minute that it ceases to become a lived experience question as opposed to an academic one, I think we've missed the whole point of embodiment. Like, embodiment there's a mind component, but even that, we think about mind, we now understand mind as an embodied phenomena. There's no aspect of self that doesn't relate to or come from the substrates of the body. So it's really about, like, yeah, living. And I think what you were saying there in terms of responding to the experiences of the day, like whatever that is, if someone listens to this episode in 10 years from now or 10 years ago, there would be something that would apply, because there are always things happening in the world that are unjust and unfair and are harming people. What I love about embodiment is that there's so many layers to what turning towards the body does. Sometimes what happens when we turn to the body at first, is we make contact with our reactions and the trauma response. Sometimes we feel the terror, the rage, the panic, the I gotta get out of this skin and I gotta get out of this place, the mobilization tendency. And actually, what's fascinating about the body is that there is a way to stay with that too, navigate through that, support ourselves with those reactions, explore where they come from, and get to other places inside of ourselves. That embodiment is all of it. It's the experience of turning towards our body and recognizing that our body is constantly communicating about what it's like to be us in a social space at a particular time in history. And I like to include those pieces because I think when we have a really rudimentary understanding of embodiment, we think it means maybe like ecstatic dance or like someone who just is always following their impulses. And we forget about embodiment as being this complex, evolving, changing experience of being a self in a world that is always complex and evolving and changing around us. There is no body that is not also telling a cultural story. And as culture changes, it also changes to be what it feels like to be us.
So to add on to what you said, maybe you can share some insight here. I mean, we are just meeting today for the first time, but I'm a somatically oriented trauma therapist myself. However, you know, the ways that we are approaching somatic work and the background we bring in it and our experience with clients and our, you know, just experience in general all factor into, you know, it's not like everyone who's somatically oriented is all the same or knows the same stuff. So,
right, yeah.
But I feel like one thing that I would like to, for our listeners to hear is that when we think of somatic therapies, we often think of you can only access or you can only heal what's held in the body by working with the body, which kind of implies like there's bad stuff in there. You have to get it out, which is very, you know, I think reductionistic, because what you're sort of naming is, or what at least came up for me when you were speaking, is that there's more in here than just the pain too, or the trauma reactions or the terror, like you said, that might be, that's there, but there's also the, I'm trained in sensory motor psychotherapy, and they talk about like the integrative capacity of the body to, but it's not just like bringing that experience in that was disconnected. It's also about like a physical sensation that you can experience when, you know, when you do get to where that is, it's like there's something else, there's more there with it too. So it kind of fills in something that was like blocked off that can be pleasurable, joyful, you know, a physical sense of well-being and empowerment that I literally, the first time I experienced that, I was like, why do I feel so good right now? This is weird. And also, why don't I feel like this all the time? Like, right. This is such a great, like, it's so hard to explain, but it's like, you know, and it was really just in a training where in one moment you're recalling some, you know, I was recalling where I tripped and fell in the street. It was something light. And then, you know, the helping me up from from like physically acting out the fall and then helping me up, and suddenly my body was flooded with endorphins, you know? And I was like, what? My cognitive mind was like, what in the world is happening right now? Right. This seems completely new.
Right.
So it's just so fascinating what all is in here and what all can be available and accessible.
I'm hearing what you're saying through the lens of somebody who works with a population who's experienced religious and spiritual trauma, because I think sometimes, regardless of how much we might not identify ourselves as religious, or we might not see religion and psychotherapy, even somatic therapy, as being similar, sometimes this archaic, over-spiritualized approach to healing that we might have heard of in some religious context translates to somatic work in particular, and that being like the exorcism model, the idea that there's something inside of you, it's bad, and if we just stay with it long enough and put enough pressure on it, it's going to come out. And I think it's
then it won't be there anymore.
And then it won't be there anymore. And these models and ideals of healing that highlight, one, like healing should be seen as an off-on switch, which is just absurd. Like, ooh, you do the work and then it's over. The other piece of it too, which really implies like, oh, if you haven't gotten through it, you haven't done enough work and you're not good enough, essentially. You haven't demonstrated faithfulness, not in this context to a religious framework, but to your therapeutic modality. And I think it can be really ableist and it can be really problematic and blaming of people. So when you talk about being connected to the other stuff inside, I think that like that's really the approach that we need to have to somatic work and understanding any kind of trauma work, which is there is always good. There's always the capacity to heal and rewire and reorganize and feel good and feel pleasure. And there is so much right about us And that is even more true than any of the stories of pain or the places that feel stuck that we carry inside. And again, that comes, like I'm weaving together a couple of theories when I say that, but the homeostatic self-correcting mechanism, which implies that our body is always organizing us towards homeostasis. It's the thing that's happening, why we sweat when we're hot, right? Our body just knows how to take care of us. And sometimes the way that it takes care of us, we've conflated with pathology and we've given a diagnostic label to, and people have felt shame for culturally and personally. And yet there's genius in the body. Even the things that kind of appear like dysfunction, there's always a reason for how they are so right. So there's the homeostatic self-correcting mechanism. And then there's the transformational drive, which is the theory that we talk about in that AADP-based paper I was talking about COVID, that the transformational drive implies that right from the get-go, we have the capacity and we have the foundational ingredients in our nervous system. And particularly when we have our relational needs met, when we have attachment needs met, when we have the conditions around us, the transformational drive can show more of itself, but it is always there. And it is always driving us towards integration, growth, transformation, healing, if you want to call it that, remaking, reorganizing, including, and this is a really simple example, a person who says there's no hope but comes to therapy, right? The example of a person like that is evidence of something inside of us that is so right, that in spite of having been hurt, we feel propelled to take a risk with a new person who could hurt us again. Wow, what a mysterious, magical thing that's inside of us, that potential. So yes, to come back to your statement, there is so much good and right inside of us. And I think if we continue to perpetuate the exorcism approach to somatic work, we are missing what's actually most true about us as humans, which is that there is wisdom, that there's so much goodness and wisdom inside of us. And that's just true, like full stop.
Yes. It's like the work is to remove the barriers to accessing that.
And maybe like another beef that I have while we're running down the list, the beef I think is with this approach to healing and somatic work that I found is how individual the model can be at times, like how it can at times perpetuate this kind of individualistic approach to healing and miss that there have been for millennia cultural ways of healing somatically that exist within, like embedded at a community level, like dancing and singing and having people intergenerationally like hold your body and practices about being held by nature and land. And so I think my hope and my longing while we're on the conversation of somatic healing and kind of the paradigm of is there badness inside that we have to extricate from the body, my thinking is like, wow, like so much of our healing process goes awry. Even our approaches to understanding healing go awry when we separate people from other people. And that really what we're meant to be doing is sharing pain and telling the truth and feeling in community and together, that relationship is such a strong component of righting things that go wrong.
An example of the way that colonization, you know, has separated people from their connections
mm-hmm.
on purpose.
Yeah.
You know,
right,
that's exactly. Part of how divide and conquer.
Yeah. And this, I mean, this is my interpretation of an Audre Lorde quote, but she says something to the effect of when people are separated from their bodies, they are much easier to control.
Yeah.
There's like separation from each other and from the body is really useful in systems of hierarchical power. And we can look at that in terms of the body of land too, right? Like there is everything that I'm saying about bodies as having wisdom and knowing the way is true of all kinds of matter and terrain. I mean, bodies are good in the way that nature is good. Bodies know the way in the same way that a tree knows the way to bend towards the light. Like there is, I'm not thinking about this from a, I'm thinking about it maybe in from a post-humanist perspective, that our bodies are pathways to connect to what is true between all of us, and all of us, including land kin and plant kin and animals and of the air and of the water. Like, there is something in nature that knows the way, and that's in us too.
Yes. Once the temps started rising, I realized it was time for a new bedspread. So I gave my old bedspread an upgrade with Quince. You might be familiar with clothing options available at Quince, but did you know they also have home items, including furniture, wall art, and much more? The best part? Everything with Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than what you'd find at similar brands. Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I'm a pretty sensory sensitive person. I found a 100% organic hot bedspread that complements my bedroom design beautifully, and the weight and texture of the fabric is just right. I want to feel the weight of a blanket on me at night in the summer, but I don't want to be hot. Treat your home to a little summer glow up with Quince. Go to quince.com/chat for free shipping on your order and 365-day return. That's quince.com/chat to get free shipping and 365-day return. Quince.com/. Today's episode is sponsored by Psychotherapy Networker and PESI. If you're a therapist, be sure to check out the partner page, which is linked in the show notes, where you can get discounted trainings with previous Therapy Chat guests like Courtney Armstrong, Dr. Leslie Korn, Dr. Ariel Schwartz, Dr. Tammy Nelson, Dr. Janina Fisher, Rebecca Case, Dr. Peter Levine, Dr. Lindsay Gibson, Deb Dana, Lori Gottlieb, and many others. You'll find the link in the show notes to my partner page with PESI and Psychotherapy Networker, where you can find all these discounted training. If you need CEs, this is a great place to go. Have you ever had those days where everything just feels harder than usual? I've definitely had my fair share, and I totally get how frustrating it can be. Sometimes it's not just stress or lack of sleep. It could be hormones at play. That's where Happy Mammoth comes in. They offer a free 2-minute quiz that can help you uncover the root cause of your hormonal symptoms. It's super easy. Just answer a few questions about what you're going through and where you're at in life. After taking the quiz, you'll get a personalized recommendation to help balance your hormones and start feeling better. Hormone Harmony is an herbal formula that fine-tunes the hormonal system. We often think we need big lifestyle changes to feel better, but in reality, small habits like taking Hormone Harmony every day can have a huge impact on how we feel. Head over to happymammoth.com and take their free 2-minute hormone quiz today to find the ultimate answer to your stubborn hormonal issues. And for a limited time, you can also get 15% off your entire first order with my code CHAT at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code CHAT for 15% off today. Therapy Notes is consistently transforming the way therapists manage their practices with continuous updates designed to save money and improve efficiency. Their latest game changer, Therapy Fuel, a powerful and fully integrated suite of AI tools that streamline documentation so you can focus more on your clients. With AI features that help by generating progress notes from summaries or transcriptions, creating contact notes directly from client secure messages, and automated summaries of client history forms, Therapy Notes users are already reporting hours of saved time and energy. Some other recent feature improvements include automated recurring client payments, electronic secondary insurance billing, and their constantly expanding library of outcome measures. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today. Well, I agree with every word you're saying. And I love that you're saying it. It's so beautifully. Another thing I'm thinking about while we're talking about, you know, you brought up spiritual abuse, and that's a type of, or spiritual trauma, that's a type of harm and pain, something to address, I guess I'll say, that is, I feel like it's really tricky to identify that one even has this. Like the first time I talk with someone about purity culture, as they were talking about it, I was like, oh yeah, purity culture, I get it. And then as they were talking, I was like, I just realized how much it impacted myself too, in ways that I wasn't realizing. Even just, I mean, it was, and it landed like gulp, you know what I mean? And it's just like, whoa. And I'm not even able to really put it into words. because there's nothing I can say for myself that was like, you know, a clear, it's just like we have these definitions of things. So, well, I don't know that anything specifically bad happened, you know, but of course I can point to certain things that I would say were specifically bad things that happened. But in terms of like spiritual trauma, religious trauma for myself, but I think it's important to talk about that because people, it's affecting us, but we don't recognize it. And then we don't know how to explain it or find a way to change what's happening for us. And because it's like so intangible and it goes along with those nonverbal types of things like oppression and deprivation and lack of attachment needs being met, that what didn't happen, we just don't, what didn't happen or what did happen that was just so much like the water that we're swimming in, is it's really hard to even define within ourselves that there's a need to address something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so nebulous. It's so ever-present and unnameable. But yeah. I think unless a person has specifically experienced a acutely distressing religious de-identification process, where, you know, where a person has deconstructed their faith or has moved away from religion and done the slow, painful work of pulling those things apart, or has been exiled from a community in a kind of immediate way, it's really hard to put our finger on how ubiquitous spiritual trauma is. And I think, you know, in my most recent book, Holy Hurt, which came out not that long ago, one of the arguments that I end up making is that the absolute rampant and, again, ubiquitous nature of spiritual trauma, particularly in North America, comes from the foundation of there being white bodies on indigenous land. Like, mm-hmm. when we actually trace that back, where does colonization come from in terms of North American history? It comes from the doctrine of discovery. It comes from the church and the state making a decision that lands were undiscovered and that they needed to be claimed and conquered for God. And that really, like, that doctrine gave people the impetus and, according to them, the right to come and colonize this beautiful land that had been inhabited with rich history and tradition. And so when I think about, like, gosh, why is this so baked into so many people's experiences? It makes sense. Like, it's part of the fabric of why whiteness exists on indigenous land. So that must, in terms of creating a foundation for things, filter through so many of our systems. And just to be clear, when I'm talking about spiritual and religious trauma, like, there's a couple ways that I talk about it. The first one, I really like a definition that comes from something I'm pulling from a scholar named Michelle Panchuk. And she talks about how religious and spiritual trauma is connected to, you know, any event where the trauma is connected to a person who's a stand-in for God or is interpreted through the lens of a theological framework. So even, for example, if somebody was told growing up, bad things don't happen to you unless God wants them to, and then a bad thing, a really awful or horrible thing happens, and their only meaning-making structure is that God wanted this to happen, then there is considered, like, there's a divine causality to their trauma, which, I mean, how do you go on after that? Like, it's so painful. So anytime somebody uses religious meaning making, even in terms of processing their trauma or making sense of it. But the argument that I make in the book is that I don't think that there's a trauma that isn't spiritual trauma, because when we understand trauma as like this kind of fragmenting process that happens because of overwhelm and the inability to cope, again, not because of failure of us, but because the situation was too much or not enough, There's that piece of it. Spirituality is this inborn desire to make meaning, to ask questions about meaning, to seek connection. I don't know a single trauma survivor who hasn't experienced fragmentation to their ability to make meaning in the world or to feel close and connected to a felt sense of safety about being in life or connection to themselves and their bodies and to ultimate connection. So I don't think that there is any kind of trauma that doesn't impact us on a spiritual level, even if you have never physically touched, even if, you know, there was no body boundary violation component to it. I think that this is, spirituality is at our core, this like, yeah, this drive to make meaning and connect. And that's, yeah, that's impacted profoundly whenever something ruptures our ability to be here.
That makes sense. And it's like,
yeah, and it's everywhere, right? We're like, oh,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, again, the colonization, the justification is religious, but the real, to me, like, it's about extraction, it's about greed, you know, desire for power. Maybe the people who were doing that, I guess many of them may have actually had religious belief behind their actions, but it's, how do you ever make sense of a war in the name of religion? Like, that just doesn't make sense. If religion is about, you know, if God is about love, then how is war ever, like, it just doesn't.
Yeah.
I never understood that as a kid and I still don't.
Yeah.
I just don't.
I think you saw through some of the things that were there, including the idea that for some, religion wasn't about love. It was about safety and power and being right, because they were afraid. Sometimes being right can feel like a powerful inoculation against the fear of being wrong. But sometimes the fear has also been made up, the things to be afraid of, and we're come from like rudimentary ways of understanding existence when there's disease and pathology that runs rampant. Or, I mean, there's so many ways of understanding history through different lenses. But I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say that in religiously and spiritually abusive context, the same kind of power that exists in abusive relationships in other contexts exists. It's just enacted on a mass scale. The power and control dynamics of abuse can happen systemically, not just interpersonally on a one-to-one level.
So true. Oh, gosh. Well, I know we don't have a lot of time left, and there were two things that we wanted to talk about that we didn't really get to, but do you have like a few more minutes
and
we can just kind of touch on those? Okay. So one is, it really all ties together with this disembodiment, embodiment discussion. Like, I know you have a podcast called Other People's Problems, and I believe season 5 is coming out soon, right?
May 12th.
Okay, yeah. So this will be released kind of close to that. And you share from therapy sessions on your podcast. So I'm really curious. I told you about this before we started, that for me, something I've been curious about is how people who desire to share their story and want to help others through sharing their story can do so in a context where it's also holding in mind their safety, you know, their emotional safety, because I feel often in trauma, we have this urge to, we want someone to hear, we want someone to understand. And it's not always, sometimes there's like a backlash later. So on many podcasts where there's no therapeutic container whatsoever, people are going and sharing the worst thing that ever happened to them. And then what happens after that? So I'm curious how you hold that on your show, being a therapist yourself.
This is such an important dynamic because I think it highlights the tension inside of me as a clinician who's both a traumatologist and feminist in orientation, to think about everybody having a right to self-govern in terms of how they disclose their story and how they talk about it, and having agency to make choices about what could potentially be therapeutic for them, while also thinking about safety and how sometimes we don't necessarily know how we're going to feel down the road. Like you said, like, there could be some internal backlash, or are we feeling prepared enough to manage what will happen if we feel exposed in a way that we're not necessarily ready to be exposed? And can we always make those decisions for ourselves when we're stuck in a reenactment loop, or we're, you know, we're just trying to please someone? So what's helpful to know about the podcast, which includes real audio from therapy sessions, is when the audio is there's a massive consent process that we engage in, including risks and benefits. There's lots of conversation about if we want to say yes, if we want to say no, what the risks to that are now, later, long term. What's important to note too about the recording process is that I actually record a lot of my sessions anyway. We do recording pretty regularly in AADP therapy so that we can watch our tapes clinically to assess for how we're doing, but also so clients can have a record of their own growth work. So the idea of recording isn't something that is new to many of my patients because we're doing it regularly. And for people who dissociate in session, having a recording on their phone, a voice note of what happened to go back to and go, oh, wow, I did say that. Oh, and this is how you did show up. It can be so therapeutic. So there's the issue of recording. And then what's important to note is that as we record, sometimes people go, okay, not, you know, if we were recording just for other people's problems, they'd say, this isn't feeling good. We need to stop this. We need to dump the tape. The tape would at some point sit for a while. We'd come back to it. You still feel open with me sharing this with the producer. Okay. Going through consent processes around who gets access to the recording, then it gets scrubbed for any anonymizing or for any details so that it's anonymized. People are picking a pseudonym. Then they're getting to hear the edits multiple times before it goes to air. And we give people permission, and people have done this like on many occasions, pull the audio because, you know, from the moment that we record it to the moment it's going to air, it's been a year later. So they've had a lot of chances to listen to it, hear it, think about it. We've processed it in therapy. We've gone back to the risks. We've gone back to the benefits. They've changed in some way. And I might feel like, oh, that doesn't represent me. Or, oh, that feels like so long ago. Like, oh, that's, you know, it's not fresh in the same way. And then when people have the final say in terms of it being on the air, then there's been so much processing around it. And they still have the right to pull it if they want to. I mean, it's hard when things live on the internet, but that's true of like a photo that we post in high school or now, you know, like a comment on something. You can't necessarily get things off the internet, but we have privileged people's rights to self-determine what is good for them. And what has been fascinating is that for the most part, people have said that being able to know my story and my therapeutic work is helping other people makes it even better for me to keep doing this work, keep working in therapy, keep sharing the audio if I need to. So there can be something actually liberating, not mm-hmm. just exploitative, right? If we handle it really well and we give a person a chance to say no, and they really can say no, and we encourage people to do that. And there's a whole therapeutic process around supporting people to say no to that I go through. But I think what we miss is potentially how beneficial it can be for people to right. feel like they're a part of changing culture, that they're destigmatizing mental health concerns and therapeutic support in a way that they're directly going to see the benefits of.
Wow, that's really cool. And y'all spend a lot more time on pre-production than I do. Yeah. A lot more. Like I said, this will be coming out, you know, today's April 29th. And you said May 12th is your, you know, season 5 launch. So
yeah, we've been working on this season since 2023, because wow. this season includes psychedelic psychotherapy. So not only do we have the regular components of consent and risk and benefit, we also have altered states of consciousness. We have questions of what, you know, what did I say during the session and how do I feel about it after, that exists for anyone doing psychedelic therapy, let alone if it's recorded and other people are going to hear it. But what's different about this season that I think is really cool is for any listeners who've heard other people's problems in the past, we haven't done this. All of the people who are included in their episodes are actually including audio after the fact that was recorded with the producer to talk about their experience. So you get to hear both what does the person sound like when they're processing on psychedelics and what does the person say about it after. And you get to hear a person reflect back and go, oh, no, that thing that I said at that time, here's what it meant and here's what it means to me now. And I really yeah. think that time, the time to be in a different state, the time to reflect, the time to consider how does it feel now, the time to evolve and develop as a person is part of the credibility of the consent process. That I really think that consent is not something that exists in a moment, but if it's a yes, then it's a yes that will hold up over time in different states of consciousness, in different experiences, in different points of time, at different stages of the healing process. And because it's therapy and not just a casual conversation, and people are doing process work about really horrific traumas, it's so, so, so important that we do not take their agency from them further, but also that they're protected and they have the right to say no.
Well, that's really helpful. And also, I just want to say, like, the what you're saying about consent, it's like ongoing, enthusiastic consent.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Not just like, okay, which is more like submit, you know?
Yeah.
But that's really beautiful. And if we have enough time, I'd love to just briefly go into talking a little bit more about psychedelic therapy.
I probably have about 5 minutes total.
Okay.
So if we can do that in 5 minutes, let's do
it. Okay. Yeah. Let's just briefly touch on it, because I think the part that I want to talk about the most, I mean, people are really curious and fascinated by psychedelics. And there's, again, like I think there could be embodied ways to approach psychedelic work and disembodied ways. And I know that you're an embodiment oriented therapist. So can you just say a little bit about, like, the way that you're approaching psychedelic therapy in season 5?
Yeah.
I'll kind of tie it together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Nicely done there. So there's a couple different approaches that I'm using in season 5 of Other People's Problems, which reflect the way that I practice. And that is to use somatic and attachment-based approaches to psychedelic therapy. One of the things that I've learned in my training, and this comes from the PSIP model, the psychedelic somatic interactional model, is that it is really easy for people to use psychedelics as a means of replicating their defense and coping mechanisms, which for many of us have included dissociation, like leaving the body. And if psychedelics, when we actually break down the compound word, like psyche and delio, looking at mind manifesting or mind revealing, what we're seeing is that so much of the psychedelic process shows us what's inside. And if what's inside has been, I'm going to get away to manage this, it is possible for people to engage in psychedelic therapy and just replicate their dissociative process. Just go away, just go transpersonal, which I don't think is bad or dangerous or shouldn't be desired even on some level. But I think when we're looking at it from a therapeutic perspective, or when we're looking at it from a trauma processing perspective, it may be one of the reasons why people kind of stay stuck in their process after big journeys, is because they're not integrating in the medicine experience the mind-body connection, but there is actually like a going away from the body that happens, or going away from relationship, which is one of my beefs with so many of the actual clinical models of psychedelic therapy that we use, which are put your eye shades on, put the music on, and be on your own, which for some people might feel like exactly what it was like to be in a childhood neglect. Like, just go inside on your own, go inside, do it by yourself.
Being in the crib and no one's coming.
Exactly. And like, oh, great, you have some intense music on. Like, I think that there can be some usefulness for that approach and there can be some beauty in it. But like any good therapy, we're not prescribing a form of treatment that is a panacea for every presenting concern in every nervous system, which means if we don't know how to adapt to work with the person who has neglect trauma or complex trauma in a way that brings them into the body and into relationship and works with transference, then we might just be saying, do the thing you always did to survive, which isn't going to help someone get a new place, even if they get connected to be all, which again, can be so powerful and beautiful. So what you're hearing on the episodes is really deep attachment somatic work, which is coming back to where we started. The staying with the body, tracking the body process, tracking the attachment interpersonal process, tracking what's happening in terms of projection, transference, countertransference, working with elements of relationship and sensation as a means of still assuming what's inside is telling us, or what we're seeing in the trip is telling us about what's inside and what it's been like to be that person, but allowing us to actually like start to work with something. And whenever I'm teaching about psychedelics, what I always say is good psychedelic therapy is good therapy plus psychedelics at the right dose. So if I'm assuming good psychedelic therapy means just like, okay, be on your own with something. I mean, maybe there's a condition under which I would suggest that for a patient, like, okay, go on a walk and journal or reflect on this between sessions. But in session, I would probably never say, just be alone with yourself with this. So good therapy, I think, includes connection and includes felt sense and inner tracking and noticing of the body. And if we can bring that into psychedelic therapy, I think we can really change our outcomes for the better.
Thank you. That was a lot to be able to speak to so succinctly. So I really appreciate that. And I hope that when people are listening to this, it's just thought-provoking about, oh, like, how can therapy be? And, you know, what could be possible for myself instead of this, you know, we just have this certain way of thinking about therapy is I go to someone, they fix me, you know, maybe I lay on a sofa, they might talk, they say, tell me about your mother, whatever. Right. And there's so much more than that available. So Hillary, where can people find what you're doing?
So you can find me on my website, in places I'm speaking or events that I'm hosting, HillaryLMcBride.com. I'm also probably most active on Instagram, HillaryLianaMcBride. You can hear Other People's Problems, season 5, or every other season prior to that. And I've got a number of books. You can find those on my website or anywhere that you buy books.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being my guest on Therapy Chat today.
It was such a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Lauren. Thanks for everyone who was listening along.
Therapy Notes is the highest rated EHR, practice management, and billing software for mental health professionals. Its all-in-one platform is designed to streamline all aspects of your practice, from connecting with clients via secure messages to scheduling, notes, billing, and more. You can trust Therapy Notes has you covered. And one of the best parts, 24/7 customer service with a live person. It's beyond easy to get help over the phone or by email at any time of day from their knowledgeable and friendly representatives. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Thank you for listening to Therapy Chat with your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC. For more information, please visit therapychatpodcast.com.